9. Eddie picked Susanna up, held her with his sticky hands locked together at the small of her back, and kissed her deeply. He reeked of sweat and pine tar. She touched his cheeks, his neck. She ran her hands through his wet hair. She felt an insane urge to touch him everywhere until she was absolutely sure of his reality. "It almost had me," he said. "It was like being on some crazy carnival ride. What a shot! Jesus, Suze, what a shot!" "I hope I never have to do anything like that again," she said. But a small voice at the center of her demurred. That voice suggested that she could not wait to do something like that again, and it was cold, that voice, cold. "What was—" he began, turning toward Roland, but Roland was no longer standing there. He was walking slowly toward the bear, which now lay on the ground with its shaggy knees up. From within it came a series of muffled gasps and gurgles as its strange guts continued to slowly run down. Roland saw his knife planted deep in a tree near the scarred veteran that had saved Eddie's life. He pulled it free and wiped it clean on the soft deerskin shirt which had replaced the tatters he had been wearing when the three of them had left the beach. He stood by the bear, looking down at it with an expression of pity and wonder. "Hello, stranger," he thought. "Hello, old friend. I never believed in you, not really. I believe Alan did, and I know that Cuthbert did. Cuthbert believed in everything. But I was the hard-headed one. I thought you were only a tale for children, another wind which blew around in my old nurse's hollow head before finally escaping her jabbering mouth. But you were here all along, another refugee of the old times, like the pump at the way station and the old machines under the mountains. Are the slow mutants who worship those broken remnants the final descendants of the people who once lived in this forest and finally fled your wrath? I don't know. We'll never know. But it feels right. Yes. And then I came with my friends, my deadly new friends, who are becoming so much like my deadly old friends. We came, weaving our magic circle around us and around everything we touch, strand by poisonous strand, and now here you lie at our feet. The world has moved on again, and this time, old friend, it's you who have been left behind." The monster's body still radiated a deep, sick heat. Parasites were leaving its mouth and tattered nostrils in hordes, but they died almost at once. Waxy white piles of them were growing on either side of the bear's head. Eddie approached slowly. He had shifted Susanna over to one hip, carrying her as a mother might carry a baby. "What was it, Roland, do you know?"
"He called it a guardian, I think," Susanna said.
"Yes." Roland's voice was slow with amazement. "I thought they were all gone. Must all be gone. If they ever existed outside of the old wives' tales in the first place."
"Whatever it was one crazy mother," Eddie said.
Roland smiled a little. "If you'd lived 2,000 or 3,000 years, you'd be one crazy mother, too."
2,000 or 3,000? Christ!"
Susanna said.
"Is it a bear? Really? And what's that?"
She was pointing at what appeared to be a square metal tag set high on one of the bear's thick rear legs. It was almost overgrown with tough tangles of hair, but the afternoon sun had pricked out a single star point of light on its stainless steel surface, revealing it. Eddie knelt and reached hesitantly toward the tag, aware that strange muffled clicks and clacks were still coming from deep inside the fallen giant. He looked at Roland.
"Go ahead," the gunslinger told him. "It's finished."
Eddie pushed a clump of hair aside and leaned closer. Words had been stamped into the metal. They were quite badly eroded, but he found that with a little effort he could read them. "North Central Positronics Limited. Granite City, Northeast Corridor. Design 4, Guardian. Serial number AA24123CX7554312971L14. Type species, bear. Shardic. NR. Subnuclear cells must not be replaced. NR.
Holy Jesus! This thing is a robot, Eddie said softly.
It can't be, Susanna said. When I shot it, it bled.
Maybe so. But your ordinary garden-variety bear doesn't have a radar dish grown out of its head. And so far as I know, your ordinary garden-variety bear doesn't live to be two or three
He broke off suddenly, looking at Roland. When he spoke again, his voice was revolted.
Roland, what are you doing?
Roland did not reply, did not need to reply. What he was doing, gouging out one of the bear's eyes with his knife, was perfectly obvious. The surgery was quick, neat, and precise. When it was completed, he balanced an oozing brown ball of jelly on the blade of his knife for a moment, and then flicked it aside. A few more worms made their way out of the staring hole, tried to squirm their way down the bear's muzzle, and died. The gunslinger leaned over the eye socket of Shardik, the great guardian bear, and peered inside.
"Come and look, both of you," he said. "I'll show you a wonder of the latter days."
"Put me down, Eddie," Susanna said.
He did so, and she moved swiftly on her hands and upper thighs to where the gunslinger was hunkered down over the bear's wide, slack face. Eddie joined them, looking between their shoulders. The three of them gazed in rapt silence for nearly a full minute. The only noise came from the crows, which still circled and scolded in the sky. Blood oozed from the socket in a few thick, dying trickles. Yet it was not just blood, Eddie saw. There was also a clear fluid which gave off an identifiable scent. Bananas. And embedded in the delicate crisscross of tendons which shaped the socket, he saw a webwork of what looked like strings. Beyond them, at the back of the socket, was a red spark, blinking on and off. It illuminated a tiny square board marked with silvery squiggles of what could only be solder.
"It isn't a bear, it's a fucking Sony Walkman," he muttered.
Susanna looked around at him.
"What?"
"Nothing."
Eddie glanced at Roland. "Do you think it's safe to reach in?"
Roland shrugged. "I think so. If there was a demon in this creature, it's fled."
Eddie reached in with his little finger, nerves set to draw back if he felt even a tickle of electricity. He touched the cooling meat inside the eye socket, which was nearly the size of a baseball, and then one of those strings. Except it wasn't a string. It was a gossamer-thin strand of steel. He withdrew his finger and saw the tiny red spark blink once more before going out forever.
"Shardik," Eddie murmured. "I know that name. But I can't place it. Does it mean anything to you, Suze?"
She shook her head.
"The thing is," Eddie laughed helplessly, "I associate it with rabbits. Isn't that nuts?"
Roland stood up. His knees popped like gunshots. "We'll have to move camp," he said. "The ground here is spoiled. The other clearing, the one where we go to shoot, will—"
He took two trembling steps and then collapsed to his knees, palms pressed to the sides of his sagging head. 10. Eddie and Susanna exchanged a single frightened glance, and then Eddie leaped to Roland's side.
"What is it? Roland, what's wrong?"
"There was a boy," the gunslinger said in a distant, muttering voice. And then, in the very next breath, "There wasn't a boy."
"Roland?"
Susanna asked. She came to him, slipped an arm around his shoulders, felt him trembling.
"Roland, what is it?"
"The boy," Roland said, looking at her with floating, dazed eyes. "It's the boy. Always the boy."
"What boy?" Eddie yelled frantically. "What boy?"
"Go then," Roland said. "There are other worlds than these." And fainted. 11.
That night, the three of them sat around a huge bonfire Eddie and Susanna had built in the clearing Eddie called the Shooting Gallery. It would have been a bad place to camp in the wintertime, open to the valley as it was, but for now it was fine. Eddie guessed that here in Roland's world it was still late summer. The black vault of the sky arched overhead, speckled by what seemed to be whole galaxies. Almost straight ahead, to the south, across the river of darkness that was the valley, Eddie could see Old Mother rising above the distant, unseen horizon. He glanced at Roland, who sat huddled by the fire, with three skins wrapped around his shoulders, despite the warmth of the night and the heat of the fire. There was an untouched plate of food by his side and a bone cradled in his hands. Eddie glanced back at the sky and thought of a story the gunslinger had told him and Susanna on one of the long days they had spent moving away from the beach through the foothills and finally into these deep woods where they had found a temporary refuge. "Before time began," Roland said, "Old Star and Old Mother had been young and passionate newlyweds. Then one day there had been a terrible argument. Old Mother, who in those long-ago days had been known by her real name, which was Lydia, had caught Old Star, whose real name was Apon, hanging about a beautiful young woman named Cassiopeia. They had had a real bang-up fight, those two, a hair-pulling, eye-gouging, crockery-throwing fight. One of those thrown bits of crockery had become the earth. A smaller shard, the moon, a coal from their kitchen stove had become the sun. In the end, the gods had stepped in so Apon and Lydia might not, in their anger, destroy the universe before it was fairly begun. Cassiopeia, the saucy jade who caused the trouble in the first place, yeah, right, it's always the woman, Susanna had said at this point, had been banished to a rocking chair made of stars forever and ever. Yet not even this had solved the problem. Lydia had been willing to try again, but Apon was stiff-necked and full of pride. Yeah, always blame the man, Eddie had grunted at this point. So they had parted, and now they look at each other in mingled hatred and longing from across the star-strewn wreckage of their divorce. Apon and Lydia are 3 billion years gone, the gunslinger told them. They have become Old Star and Old Mother, the North and South, each pining for the other, but both now too proud to beg for reconciliation. And Cassiopeia sits off to the side in her chair, rocking and laughing at them both. Eddie was startled by a soft touch on his arm. It was Susanna. Come on, she said. We've got to make him talk. Eddie carried her to the campfire and put her down carefully on Roland's right side. He sat on Roland's left. Roland looked first at Susanna, then at Eddie. "How close you both sit to me," he remarked, "like lovers or warders in a jail." "It's time for you to do some talking." Susanna's voice was low, clear, and musical. "If we're your companions, Roland, and it seems like we are, like it or not, it's time you started treating us as companions. Tell us what's wrong, and what we can do about it," Eddie finished. Roland sighed deeply. "I don't know how to begin," he said. "It's been so long since I've had companions, or a tale to tell." "Start with the bear," Eddie said. Susanna leaned forward and touched the jawbone Roland held in his hands. It frightened her, but she touched it anyway. "And finish with this." "Yes." Roland lifted the bone to eye level and looked at it for a moment before dropping it back into his lap. "We'll have to speak of this, won't we? It's the center of the thing." But the bear came first. This is the story I was told when I was a child, Roland said. When everything was new, the great old ones, they weren't gods, but people who had almost the knowledge of gods, created 12 guardians to stand watch at the 12 portals which lead in and out of the world. Sometimes I heard that these portals were natural things, like the constellations we see in the sky, or the bottomless crack in the earth we call Dragon's Grave because of the great burst of steam they gave off every 30 or 40 days. But other people, one I remember in particular, the head cook in my father's castle, a man named Hax, said they were not natural, that they had been created by the great old ones themselves in the days before they hanged themselves with pride like a noose and disappeared from the earth. Hax used to say that the creation of the 12 guardians was the last act of the great old ones, their attempt to atone for the great wrongs they had done to each other and to the earth itself.
Portals, Eddie mused. Doors, you mean? Well, back to those again. Do these doors that lead in and out of the world open on the world Susan and I came from, like the ones we found along the beach?
I don't know, Roland said. For everything I do know, there are 100 things I don't. You, both of you, will have to reconcile yourselves to that fact. The world has moved on, we say. When it did, it went like a great receding wave, leaving only wreckage behind. Wreckage that sometimes looks like a map.
"Well, make a guess!" Eddie exclaimed,
and the raw eagerness in his voice told the gunslinger that Eddie had not given up the idea of returning to his own world and Susanna's even now, not entirely.
"Leave him be, Eddie," Susanna said. "The man don't guess."
"Not true. Sometimes the man does," Roland said, surprising them both. "When guessing's the only thing left, sometimes he does. The answer is no. I don't think, I don't guess, that these portals are much like the doors on the beach. I don't guess they go to a where or when that we would recognize. I think the doors on the beach, the ones that led into the world you both came from, were like the pivot at the center of a child's teeter-board. Do you know what that is?"
"Seesaw?"
Susanna asked, and tipped her hand back and forth to demonstrate. "Yes," Roland agreed, looking pleased, "just so. On one end of this seesaw, Eddie said, smiling a little. "Yes, on one end, my car. On the other, that of the man in black, Walter. The doors were the center, creations of the tension between two opposing destinies. These other portals are things far greater than Walter or me or the little fellowship we three have made."
"Are you saying," Susanna asked hesitantly, "that the portals where these guardians stand watch are outside Ka, beyond Ka?"
"I'm saying that I believe so." He offered his own brief smile, a thin sickle in the firelight. "That I guess so." He was silent a moment. Then he picked up a stick of his own. He brushed away the carpet of pine needles and used the stick to draw in the dirt beneath. "Here is the world as I was told it existed when I was a child. The X's are the portals standing in a ring at its eternal edge. If one drew 6 lines connecting these portals in pairs, so..." He looked up. "Do you see where the lines cross in the center?" Eddie felt goose flesh crawl up his back and down his arms. His mouth was suddenly dry.
"Is that it, Roland? Is that..."
Roland nodded. His long, lined face was grave. "At this nexus lies the great portal, the so-called 13th gate, which rules not just this world, but all worlds." He tapped the center of the circle. "Here is the dark tower for which I've searched my whole life." 13. The gunslinger resumed. "At each of the 12 lesser portals, the great old one set a guardian. In my childhood, I could have named them all in the rhymes my nurse made and Hax the cook taught to me, but my childhood was long ago. There was the bear, of course, and the fish, the lion, the bat, and the turtle. He was an important one." The gunslinger looked up into the starry sky, his brow creased in deep thought. Then an amazingly sunny smile broke across his features, and he recited, "See the turtle of enormous girth. On his shell he holds the earth. His thought is slow but always kind. He holds us all within his mind. On his back all vows are made. He sees the truth but mayn't aid. He loves the land and loves the sea, and even loves a child like me." Roland uttered a small, bemused laugh. "Hacks taught that to me, singing it as he stirred the frosting for some cake and gave me little nips of the sweet from the edge of his spoon. Amazing what we remember, isn't it? Anyway, as I grew older, I came to believe that the Guardians didn't really exist, that they were symbols rather than substance. It seems that I was wrong." "I called it a robot," Eddie said. "But that's not what it really was. Susanna's right. The only thing robots bleed when you shoot them is Quaker State 1040. I think it was what people of my world call a cyborg, Roland. A creature that's part machine and part flesh and blood. There was a movie I saw. We told you about movies, didn't we?" Smiling a little, Roland nodded. "Well, this movie was called RoboCop, and the guy in it wasn't a lot different from the bear Susanna killed. How did you know where she should shoot it?" "That I remembered from the old tales as Hacks told them," he said. "If it had been up to my nursemaid, Eddie, you'd be in the belly of the bear now. Do they sometimes tell puzzled children in your world to put on their thinking caps?"
"Yes," Susanna said, "they sure do."
"It's said here as well, and the saying comes from the story of the Guardians. Each supposedly carried an extra brain on the outside of its head, in a hat." He looked at them with his dreadfully haunted eyes and smiled again. "It didn't look much like a hat, did it?"
"No," Eddie said, "but the story was close enough to save our bacon."
"I think now that I've been looking for one of the Guardians ever since I began my quest," Roland said. "When we find the portal this Shardik guarded, and that should be only a matter of following its back trail, we will finally have a course to follow. We must set the portal to our backs and then simply move straight ahead. At the center of the circle, the tower."
Eddie opened his mouth to say, "All right, let's talk about this tower. Finally, once and for all, let's talk about it. What it is, what it means, and most important of all, what happens to us when we get there."
But no sound came out, and after a moment he closed his mouth again. This wasn't the time. Not now, with Roland in such obvious pain. Not now, with only the spark of their campfire to keep the night at bay. "So now we come to the other part," Roland said heavily. "I have finally found my course. After all the long years, I have found my course. But at the same time, I seem to be losing my sanity. I can feel it crumbling away beneath my feet, like a steep embankment which has been loosened by rain. This is my punishment for letting a boy who never existed fall to his death, and that is also Kaa."
"Who is this boy, Roland?" Susanna asked.
Roland glanced at Eddie. "Do you know?" Eddie shook his head. "But I spoke of him," Roland said. "In fact, I raved of him when the infection was at its worst and I was near dying." The gunslinger's voice suddenly rose half an octave, and his imitation of Eddie's voice was so good that Susanna felt a coil of superstitious fright.
"If you don't shut up about that goddamn kid, Roland, I'll gag you with your own shirt. I'm sick of hearing about him. Do you remember saying that, Eddie?"
Eddie thought it over carefully. Roland had spoken of a thousand things as the two of them made their tortuous way up the beach from the door marked the prisoner to the one marked the Lady of the Shadows, and he had mentioned what seemed like a thousand names in his fever-heated monologues. Alen, Court, Jamie DeCurry, Cuthbert, this one more often than all the others, Hacks, Martin, or perhaps it was Martin, like the animal, Walter, Susan, even a guy with the unlikely name of Zoltan. Eddie had gotten very tired of hearing about these people he had never met and didn't care to meet. But, of course, Eddie had had a few problems of his own at that time, heroin withdrawal and cosmic jet lag being only two of them. And, if he was to be fair, he guessed Roland had gotten as tired of Eddie's own fractured fairy tales, the ones about how he and Henry had grown up together and turned into junkies together, as Eddie had of Roland's. But he couldn't remember ever telling Roland he would gag him with his own shirt if he didn't stop talking about some kid.
"Nothing comes to you?" Roland asked. "Nothing at all."
Was there something? Some far-off tickle, like the feeling of deja vu he'd gotten when he saw the slingshot hiding inside the chunk of wood jutting out of the stump? Eddie tried to find that tickle, but it was gone. He decided it had never been there in the first place. He only wanted it to be there because Roland was hurting so badly.
"No," he said. "Sorry, man. But I did tell you." Roland's tone was calm, but urgency ran and pulsed beneath it like a scarlet thread. "The boy's name was Jake. I sacrificed him, killed him, in order that I might finally catch up with Walter and make him talk. I killed him under the mountains."
On this point, Eddie could be more positive.
"Well, maybe that's what happened, but it's not what you said happened. You said you went under the mountains alone, on some kind of crazy handcar. You talked about that a lot while we were coming up the beach, Roland, about how scary it was to be alone."
"I remember. But I also remember telling you about the boy and how he fell from the trestle into the chasm. And it's the distance between those two memories that is pulling my mind apart."
"I don't understand any of this," Susanna said worriedly.
"I think," Roland said, "that I'm just beginning to." He threw more wood on the fire, sending thick sheaves of red sparks spiraling up into the dark sky, and then settled back between them. "I'll tell you a story that's true," he said, "and then I'll tell you a story that isn't true, but should be. I bought a mule in Pricetown, and when I finally got to Tull, the last town before the desert, it was still fresh."
14. So the gunslinger embarked on the most recent part of his long tale. Eddie had heard isolated fragments of the story, but he listened in utter fascination, as did Susanna, for whom it was completely new. He told them about the bar with the endless game of Watch Me going on in the corner, the piano player named Sheb, the woman named Allie with the scar on her forehead, and about Nort, the weed-eater who had died and then been brought back to some sort of tenebrous life by the man in black. He told them about Sylvia Pittston, that avatar of religious insanity, and about the final apocalyptic slaughter in which he, Roland the Gunslinger, had killed every man, woman, and child in town.
"Holy crispy crap," Eddie said in a low, shaky voice.
"Now I know why you were so low on shells, Roland."
"Be quiet," Susanna snapped. "Let him finish."
Roland went on, telling his story as stolidly as he had crossed the desert after passing the hut of the last dweller, a young man whose wild, strawberry-colored hair had reached almost to his waist. He told them about how his mule had finally died. He even told them about how the dweller's pet bird, Zoltan, had eaten the mule's eyes. He told them about the long desert days and the short desert nights which had come next, and how he had followed the cool remains of Walter's campfires, and how he had come at last, reeling and dying of dehydration, to the way station.
It was empty. It had been empty, I think, since the days when yonder great bear was still a newly made thing. I stayed a night and pushed on. That's what happened. But now I'll tell you another story.
The one that isn't true but should be? Susanna asked.
Roland nodded. In this made-up story, this fable, a gunslinger named Roland met a boy named Jake at the way station. This boy was from your world, from your city of New York, and from a Wen someplace between Eddie's 1987 and Odetta Holmes's 1963. Eddie was leaning forward eagerly.
"Is there a door in this story, Roland? A door marked The Boy or something like that?"
Roland shook his head. The boy's doorway was death. He was on his way to school when a man I believed to be Walter, pushed him into the street, where he was run over by a car. He heard this man say something like, "Get out of the way, let me through, I'm a priest." Jake saw this man just for an instant, and then he was in my world. The gunslinger paused, looking into the fire. "Now, I want to leave this story of the boy who was never there and go back to what really happened for a minute, all right?" Eddie and Susanna exchanged a puzzled glance, and then Eddie made an "after you, my dear Alphonse" gesture with his hand. As I have said, the way station was deserted. There was, however, a pump that still worked. It was at the back of the stable where the coach horses were kept. I followed my ears to it, but I would have found it even if it had been completely silent. I smelled the water, you see. After enough time in the desert, when you are on the edge of dying from thirst, you can really do that. I drank, and then slept. When I woke, I drank again. I wanted to push on at once. The need to do that was like a fever. The medicine you brought me from your world, the Astin, is wonderful stuff, Eddie, but there are fevers beyond the power of any medicine to cure, and this was one of them. I knew my body needed rest, but it still took every ounce of my willpower to stay there even one night. In the morning, I felt rested, and so I refilled my water skins and pushed on. I took nothing from that place but water. That's the most important part of what really happened. Susanna spoke in her most reasonable, pleasant, and Odetta Holmes-like voice. "All right, that's what really happened. You refilled your water skins and went on. Now tell us the rest of what didn't happen, Roland." The gunslinger put the jawbone in his lap for a moment, curled his hands into fists, and rubbed his eyes with them, a curiously childlike gesture. Then he grasped the jawbone again, as if for courage, and went on. "I hypnotized the boy who wasn't there," he said. "I did it with one of my shells. It's a trick I've known for years, and I learned it from a very unlikely source, Martin, my father's court magician. The boy was a good subject. While he was tranced, he told me the circumstances of his death, as I've told them to you. When I'd gotten as much of his story as I felt I could without upsetting or actually hurting him, I gave him a command that he should not remember anything about his dying when he woke up again."
"Who'd want to?" Eddie muttered.
Roland nodded. "Who indeed? The boy passed from his trance directly into a natural sleep. I also slept. When we woke, I told the boy that I meant to catch the man in black. He knew who I meant. Walter had also stopped at the way station. Jake was afraid and hid from him. I'm sure Walter knew he was there, but it suited his purpose to pretend he didn't. He left the boy behind like a set trap. I asked him if there was anything to eat there. It seemed to me there must be. He looked healthy enough, and the desert climate is wonderful when it comes to preserving things. He had a little dried meat, and he said there was a cellar. He hadn't explored that because he was afraid." The gunslinger looked at them grimly. "He was right to be afraid. I found food. And I also found a speaking demon." Eddie looked down at the jawbone with widening eyes. Orange firelight danced on its ancient curves and hoodoo teeth.
"Speaking demon? Do you mean that thing?"
"No," he said. "Yes. Both. Listen, and you shall understand." He told them about the inhuman groans he'd heard coming from the earth beyond the cellar, how he had seen sand running from between two of the old blocks which made up the cellar walls. He told them of approaching the hole that was appearing there as Jake screamed for him to come up. He had commanded the demon to speak, and so the demon had, in the voice of Allie, the woman with the scar on her forehead, the woman who had kept the bar in Tull. "Go slow past the drawers, gunslinger. While you travel with the boy, the man in black travels with your soul in his pocket."
"The drawers?" Susanna asked, startled.
"Yes. Roland looked at her closely.
That means something to you, doesn't it?
Yes. And no. She spoke with great hesitation. Some of it, Roland divined, was simple reluctance to speak of things which were painful to her. He thought most of it, however, was a desire not to confuse issues which were already confused by saying more than she actually knew. He admired that. He admired her.
"Say what you can be sure of," he said, "no more than that."
"All right. The drawers was a place Detta Walker knew about, a place Detta thought about. It's a slang term, one she picked up from listening to the grown-ups when they sat out on the porch and drank beer and talked about the old days. It means a place that's spoiled or useless or both. There was something in the drawers, in the idea of the drawers, that called to Detta. Don't ask me what. I might have known once, but I don't anymore, and don't want to. Detta stole my Aunt Blue's china plate, the one my folks gave her for a wedding present, and took it to the drawers, her drawers, to break it. That place was a gravel pit filled with trash, a dumping ground. Later on, she sometimes picked up boys at roadhouses.
Susanna dropped her head for a moment, her lips pressed tightly together. Then she looked up again and went on.
"White boys. And when they took her back to their cars in the parking lot, she cock-teased them and then ran off. Those parking lots, they were the drawers, too. It was a dangerous game, but she was young enough, quick enough, and mean enough to play it to the hilt and enjoy it. Later in New York, she'd go on shoplifting expeditions. You know about that, both of you. Always to the fancy stores, Macy's, Gimbel's, Bloomingdale's, and steal trinkets. And when she made up her mind to go on one of those sprees, she'd think, 'I'm going to the drawers today, gonna steal me some shit from the white folks, gonna steal me something for special, and then break that sumbitch.'"
She paused, lips trembling, looking into the fire. When she looked around again, Roland and Eddie saw tears standing in her eyes.
"I'm crying, but don't let that fool you. I remember doing those things, and I remember enjoying them. I guess I'm crying because I know I'd do it all again if the circumstances were right."
Roland seemed to have regained some of his old serenity, his weird equilibrium. "We have a proverb in my country, Susanna. The wise thief always prospers."
"I don't see nothing wise about stealing a bunch of paste jewelry," she said sharply.
"Were you ever caught?"
"No."
He spread his hands as if to say, "There you have it."
"So for Detta Walker, the drawers were bad places?" Eddie asked. "Is that right? Because it doesn't exactly feel right." "Bad and good at the same time. They were powerful places, places where she reinvented herself, I suppose you could say. But they were lost places, too. And this is all off the subject of Roland's ghost boy, isn't it?"
"Maybe not," Roland said. "We had drawers as well, you see, in my world. It was slang for us, too, and the meanings are very similar."
"What did it mean to you and your friends?" Eddie asked.
"That varied slightly from place to place and situation to situation. It might mean a trash midden, it might mean a whorehouse or a place where men came to gamble or chew devil weed. But the most common meaning that I know is also the simplest."
He looked at them both.
"The drawers are places of desolation," he said. "The drawers are the wastelands."
XV. This time Susanna threw more wood on the fire. In the south, Old Mother blazed on brilliantly, not flickering. She knew from her school studies what that meant. It was a planet, not a star. "Venus?" she wondered. "Or is the solar system of which this world is a part as different as everything else?" Again that feeling of unreality, the feeling that all this must surely be a dream, washed over her.
"Go on," she said. "What happened after the voice warned you about the drawers and the little boy?"
"I punched my hand into the hole the sand had come from, as I was taught to do if such a thing ever happened to me. What I plucked forth was a jawbone, but not this one. The jawbone I took from the wall of the way station was much larger, from one of the great old ones, I have almost no doubt."
"What happened to it?" Susanna asked quietly. "One night I gave it to the boy," Roland said. The fire painted his cheeks with hot orange highlights and dancing shadows. "As a protection, a kind of talisman. Later I felt it had served its purpose and threw it away."
"So whose jawbone you got there, Roland?"
Eddie asked. Roland held it up, looked at it long and thoughtfully, and let it drop back. "Later, after Jake... after he died, I caught up with the men I had been chasing."
"With Walter," Susanna said.
"Yes. We held palaver, he and I, long palaver. I fell asleep at some point, and when I woke up, Walter was dead. 100 years dead, at least, and probably more. There was nothing left of him but bones, which was fitting enough, since we were in a place of bones."
"Yeah, it must have been a pretty long palaver, all right," Eddie said dryly.
Susanna frowned slightly at this, but Roland only nodded. "Long and long," he said, looking into the fire.
"You came to in the morning and reached the Western Sea that very evening," Eddie said. "That night the Lobstrosities came, right?"
Roland nodded again. "Yes. But before I left the place where Walter and I had spoken, or dreamed, or whatever it was we did, I took this from the skull of his skeleton." He lifted the bone, and the orange light again skated off the teeth.
"Walter's jawbone," Eddie thought, and felt a little chill work through him. "The jawbone of the man in black. Remember this, Eddie, my boy, the next time you get to thinking Roland's maybe just another one of the guys. He's been carrying it around with him all this time, like some kind of a cannibal's trophy. Jesus."
"I remember what I thought when I took it," Roland said. "I remember very well. It is the only memory I have of that time which hasn't doubled on me. I thought it was bad luck to throw away what I found when I found the boy. This will replace it. Only then I heard Walter's laughter, his mean, tittery laughter. I heard his voice, too."
"What did he say?" Susanna asked.
"Too late, gunslinger," Roland said. "That's what he said. Too late. Your luck will be bad from now until the end of eternity. That is your ka."
16. "All right," Eddie said at last. "I understand the basic paradox. Your memory is divided, not divided. Doubled." "All right. It's almost the same thing, isn't it?"
Eddie grasped a twig and made his own little drawing in the sand. He tapped the line on the left.
"This is your memory of the time before you got to the way station. A single track."
"Yes."
He tapped the line on the right. "And after you came out on the far side of the mountains in the place of bones, the place where Walter was waiting for you. Also a single track."
"Yes."
Now Eddie first indicated the middle area and then drew a rough circle around it.
"That's what you've got to do, Roland. Close this double track off. Build a stockade around it in your mind, and then forget it. Because it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't change anything. It's gone. It's done, but it isn't."
Roland held up the bone. "If my memories of the boy Jake are false, and I know they are, how can I have this? I took it to replace the one I threw away. But the one I threw away came from the cellar of the way station, and along the track I know is true, I never went down cellar. I never spoke with the demon. I moved on alone with fresh water and nothing else."
"Roland, listen to me," Eddie said earnestly. "If that jawbone you're holding was the one from the way station, that would be one thing. But isn't it possible that if you hallucinated that whole thing, the way station, the kid, the speaking demon, then maybe you took Walter's jawbone because
it was no hallucination?" Roland said. He looked at them both with his faded blue bombardier's eyes, and then did something neither expected. something Eddie would have sworn Roland did not know he meant to do himself. He threw the jawbone into the fire. 17. For a moment it only lay there, a white relic bent in a ghostly half-grin. Then it suddenly blazed red, washing the clearing with dazzling scarlet light. Eddie and Susanna cried out and threw their hands up to shield their eyes from that burning shape. The bone began to change, not to melt, but to change. The teeth, which leaned out of it like gravestones, began to draw together in clumps. The mild curve of the upper arc straightened, then snubbed down at the tip. Eddie's hands fell into his lap, and he stared at the bone, which was no longer a bone, with gape-jawed wonder. It was now the color of burning steel. The teeth had become three inverted V's, the middle one larger than those on the ends. And suddenly Eddie saw what it wanted to become, just as he had seen the slingshot in the wood of the stump. He thought it was a key. "You must remember the shape," he thought feverishly. "You must, you must." His eyes traced it desperately. Three V's, the one in the center larger and deeper than the two on the end. Three notches, and the one closest the end had a squiggle, the shallow shape of a lowercase s. Then the shape in the flames changed again. The bone, which had become something like a key, drew inward, concentrating itself into bright, overlapping petals and folds, as dark and velvety as a moonless summer midnight. For a moment, Eddie saw a rose, a triumphant rose that might have bloomed in the dawn of this world's first day, a thing of depthless, timeless beauty. His eyes saw, and his heart was opened. It was as if all love and life had suddenly risen from Roland's dead artifact. It was there in the fire, burning out in triumph and some wonderful, inchoate defiance, declaring that despair was a mirage and death a dream. "The rose," he thought incoherently. "First the key, then the rose. Behold, behold the opening of the way to the tower." There was a thick cough from the fire. A fan of sparks twisted outwards. Susanna screamed and rolled away, beating at the orange flecks on her dress as the flames gushed upward toward the starry sky. Eddie didn't move. He sat transfixed in his vision, held in a cradle of wonder which was both gorgeous and terrible, unmindful of the sparks which danced across his skin. Then the flames sank back. The bone was gone. The key was gone. The rose was gone. "Remember," he thought, "remember the rose, and remember the shape of the key." Susanna was sobbing with shock and terror, but he ignored her for the moment and found the stick with which he and Roland had both drawn. And in the dirt he made this shape with a shaking hand. 18. "Why did you do it?" Susanna asked at last. "Why, for God's sake, and what was it?" 15 minutes had gone by. The fire had been allowed to burn low. The scattered embers had either been stamped out or had gone out on their own. Eddie sat with his arms about his wife. Susanna sat before him, with her back against his chest. Roland was off to one side, knees hugged to his chest, looking moodily into the orange-red coals. So far as Eddie could tell, neither of them had seen the bone change. They had both seen it glowing, super-hot, and Roland had seen it explode, or had it imploded. To Eddie that seemed closer to what he had seen. But that was all, or so he believed. Roland, however, sometimes kept his own counsel, and when he decided to play his cards close to the vest, he played them very close indeed, and he knew that from bitter experience. He thought of telling them what he had seen, or thought he had seen, and decided to play his own cards tight and close up, at least for the time being. Of the jawbone itself, there was no sign, not even a splinter.
I did it because a voice spoke in my mind and told me I must, Roland said. It was the voice of my father, of all my fathers. When one hears such a voice, not to obey and at once is unthinkable. So I was taught. As to what it was, I can't say, not now, at least. I only know that the bone has spoken its final word. I have carried it all this way to hear it. Or to see it, Eddie thought. And again, remember. Remember the rose. And remember the shape of the key. It almost flash-fried us. She sounded both tired and exasperated. Roland shook his head. I think it was more like the sort of firework the barons used to sometimes shoot into the sky at their year-end parties. Bright and startling, but not dangerous. Eddie had an idea. The doubling in your mind, Roland. Is it gone? Did it leave when the bone exploded or whatever it did? He was almost convinced that it had. In the movies he'd seen, such rough shock therapy almost always worked. But Roland shook his head. Susanna shifted in Eddie's arms. You said you were beginning to understand. Roland nodded. I think so, yes. If I'm right, I fear for Jake. Wherever he is, whenever he is, I fear for him. What do you mean? Eddie asked. Roland got up, went to his roll of hides, and began to spread them out. Enough stories and excitement for one night. It's time to sleep. In the morning we'll follow the bear's back trail and see if we can find the portal he was set to guard. I'll tell you what I know, and what I believe has happened, what I believe is happening still, along the way. With that he wrapped himself in an old blanket and a new deerskin, rolled away from the fire, and would say no more. Eddie and Susanna lay down together. When they were sure the gunslinger must be asleep, they made love. Roland heard them going about it as he lay wakeful and heard their quiet after-love talk. Most of it was about him. He lay quietly, open eyes, looking into the darkness, long after their talk had ceased and their breathing had evened out into a single, easy note. It was, he thought, fine to be young and in love. Even in the graveyard which this world had become, it was fine. Enjoy it while you can, he thought, because there is more death ahead. We have come to a stream of blood. That it will lead us to a river of the same stuff, I have no doubt, and further along, to an ocean. In this world the graves yawn, and none of the dead rest easy. As dawn began to come up in the east, he closed his eyes, slept briefly, and dreamed of Jake. 19. Eddie also dreamed. Dreamed he was back in New York, walking along Second Avenue with a book in his hand. In this dream it was spring. The air was warm, the city was blooming, and homesickness sobbed within him like a mussel with a fishhook caught deep within it. Enjoy this dream, and make it go on as long as you can, he thought. Savor it, because this is as close to New York as you're going to get. You can't go home, Eddie. That part's done. He looked down at the book, and was utterly unsurprised to find it was You Can't Go Home Again by Thomas Wolfe. Stamped into the dark red cover were three shapes, key, rose, and door. He stopped for a moment, flipped the book open, and read the first line. The man in black fled across the desert, Wolfe had written, and the gunslinger followed. Eddie closed it and walked on. It was about 9 in the morning, he judged, maybe 9:30, and traffic on Second Avenue was light. Taxis honked and wove their way from lane to lane with spring sunshine twinkling off their windshields and bright yellow paint jobs. A bum on the corner of 2nd and 52nd asked him for a handout, and Eddie tossed the book with the red cover into his lap. He observed, also without surprise, that the bum was Enrico Balazar,
He was sitting cross-legged in front of a magic shop. House of Cards, the sign in the window read, and the display inside showed a tower which had been built of tarot cards. Standing on top was a model of King Kong. There was a tiny radar dish growing out of the great ape's head. Eddie walked on, lazing his way downtown, the street signs floating past him. He knew where he was going as soon as he saw it, a small shop on the corner of 2nd and 46th. Yeah, he thought. A feeling of great relief swept through him. This is the place, the very place. The window was full of hanging meats and cheeses. Tom and Jerry's Artistic Deli, the sign read. Party platters are specialty. As he stood looking in, someone else he knew came around the corner. It was Jack Andolini, wearing a three-piece suit the color of vanilla ice cream and carrying a black cane in his left hand. Half of his face was gone, lopped off by the claws of the lobstrosities. "Go on in, Eddie," Jack said as he passed. "After all, there are other worlds than these, and that fucking train rolls through all of them." "I can't," Eddie replied. "The door is locked." He didn't know how he knew this, but he did. Knew it beyond a shadow of a doubt. "Dada chum, dada chee, not to worry, you've got the key," Jack said, not looking back. Eddie looked down and saw he did have a key, a primitive-looking thing with three notches like inverted V's. "That little S-shape at the end of the last notch is the secret," he thought. He stepped under the awning of Tom and Jerry's Artistic Deli and inserted the key in the lock. It turned easily. He opened the door and stepped through into a huge open field. He looked back over his shoulder and saw the traffic on 2nd Avenue hurrying by, and then the door slammed shut and fell over. There was nothing behind it. Nothing at all. He turned back to survey his new surroundings, and what he saw filled him with terror at first. The field was a deep scarlet, as if some titanic battle had been fought here, and the ground had been drenched with so much blood that it could not all be absorbed. Then he realized that it was not blood he was looking at, but roses. That feeling of mingled joy and triumph surged through him again, swelling his heart until he felt it might burst within him. He raised his clenched fists high over his head in a gesture of victory, and then froze that way. The field stretched on for miles, climbing a gentle slope of land, and standing at the horizon was the Dark Tower. It was a pillar of dumb stone, rising so high into the sky that he could barely discern its tip. Its base, surrounded by red, shouting roses, was formidable, titanic with weight and size. Yet the tower became oddly graceful as it rose and tapered. The stone of which it had been made was not black, as he had imagined it would be, but soot-colored. Narrow, slitted windows marched about it in a rising spiral. Below the windows ran an almost endless flight of stone stairs, circling up and up. The tower was a dark gray exclamation point, planted in the earth and rising above the field of blood-red roses. The sky arched above it was blue, but filled with puffy white clouds like sailing ships. They flowed above and around the top of the dark tower in an endless stream. "How gorgeous it is," Eddie marveled. "How gorgeous and strange." But his feeling of joy and triumph had departed. He was left with a sense of deep malaise and impending doom. He looked about him and realized with sudden horror that he was standing in the shadow of the tower. No, not just standing in it, buried alive in it. He cried out, but his cry was lost in the golden blast of some tremendous horn. It came from the top of the tower and seemed to fill the world. As that note of warning held and drew out over the field where he stood, blackness welled from the windows which girdled the tower. It overspilled them and spread across the sky in flaggy streams, which came together and formed a growing blotch of darkness. It did not look like a cloud. It looked like a tumor hanging over the earth. The sky was blotted out. And he saw it was not a cloud or a tumor, but a shape, some tenebrous cyclopean shape, racing toward the place where he stood. It would do no good to run from that beast coalescing in the sky above the field of roses. It would catch him, clutch him, and bear him away. Into the dark tower it would bear him, and the world of light would see him no more. Rents formed in the darkness, and terrible, inhuman eyes, each easily the size of the bear Shardik which lay dead in the forest, peered down at him. They were red, red as roses, red as blood. Jack Andolini's dead voice hammered in his ears. 1,000 worlds, Eddie, 10,000, and that train roll through every one. If you can get it started. And if you do get it started, your troubles are only beginning, because this device is a real bastard to shut down. Jack's voice had become mechanical, chanting. A real bastard to shut down, Eddie boy, you better believe it, this bastard is shutting down. Shutdown will be complete in 1 hour and 6 minutes. In his dream, Eddie threw his hands up to shield his eyes. 20. And woke, sitting bolt upright beside the dead campfire. He was looking at the world from between his own spread fingers. And still that voice rolled on and on, the voice of some heartless SWAT squad commander bellowing through a bullhorn. There is no danger. Repeat, there is no danger. 5 subnuclear cells are dormant. 2 subnuclear cells are now in shutdown phase. 1 subnuclear cell is operating at 2% capacity. These cells are of no value. Repeat, these cells are of no value. Report location to North Central Positronics Limited. Call 1-900-44. The code word for this device is Shardik. Reward is offered. Repeat, reward is offered. The voice fell silent. Eddie saw Roland standing at the edge of the clearing, holding Susanna in the crook of one arm. They were staring toward the sound of the voice. And as the recorded announcement began again, Eddie was finally able to shake off the chill remnants of his nightmare. He got up and joined Roland and Susanna, wondering how many centuries it had been since that announcement, programmed a broadcast only in the event of a total system breakdown, had been recorded. This device is shutting down. Shutdown will be complete in 1 hour and 5 minutes. There is no danger. Repeat, Eddie touched Susanna's arm, and she looked around. How long has this been going on?
About 15 minutes. You were dead to the...
She broke off.
Eddie, you look terrible. Are you sick?
No, I just had a bad dream. Roland was studying him in a way that made Eddie feel uncomfortable. Sometimes there's truth in dreams, Eddie. What was yours?
He thought for a moment, then shook his head.
I don't remember. You know I doubt that. Eddie shrugged and favored Roland with a thin smile. Doubt away, then. Be my guest. And how are you this morning, Roland? The same, Roland said. His faded blue eyes still conned Eddie's face.
Stop it, Susanna said.
Her voice was brisk, but Eddie caught an undertone of nervousness.
Both of you. I got better things to do than watch you two dance around and kick each other's shins like a couple of little kids playing 2 for flinching, especially this morning with that dead bear trying to yell down the whole world.
The gunslinger nodded, but kept his eyes on Eddie. All right. But are you sure there's nothing you want to tell me, Eddie?
He thought about it then, really thought about telling. What he had seen in the fire, what he had seen in his dream.
He decided against it. Perhaps it was only the memory of the rose and the fire and the roses which had blanketed that dream field in such fabulous profusion. He knew he could not tell these things as his eyes had seen them and his heart had felt them. He could only cheapen them. And, at least for the time being, he wanted to ponder these things alone. But remember, he told himself again. Except the voice in his mind didn't sound much like his own. It seemed deeper, older, the voice of a stranger.
"Remember the rose."
"You will what?" Roland asked.
"Tell," Eddie said.
"If anything comes up that seems, you know, really important, I'll tell you, both of you. Right now, there isn't. So if we're going somewhere, Shane, old buddy, let's saddle up."
"Shane? Who is this Shane?"
"I'll tell you that some other time, too. Meantime, let's go."
They packed the gear they had brought with them from the old campsite and headed back, Susanna riding in her wheelchair again. Eddie had an idea she wouldn't be riding in it for long.
21. Once, before Eddie had become too interested in the subject of heroin to be interested in much else, he and a couple of friends had driven over to New Jersey to see a couple of speed metal groups, Anthrax and Megadeth, in concert at the Meadowlands. He believed that Anthrax had been slightly louder than the repeating announcement coming from the fallen bear, but he wasn't 100% sure. Roland stopped them while they were still half a mile from the clearing in the woods and tore 6 small scraps of cloth from his old shirt. They stuffed them in their ears and then went on. Even the cloth didn't do much to deaden the steady blast of sound.
"This device is shutting down," the bear blared as they stepped into the clearing again. It lay as it had lain at the foot of the tree Eddie had climbed, a fallen colossus with its legs apart and its knees in the air, like a furry female giant who had died trying to give birth.
"Shutdown will be complete in 47 minutes. There is no danger."
"Yes, there is," Eddie thought, picking up the scattered hides, which had not been shredded in either the bear's attack or its flailing death throes.
"Plenty of danger. To my fucking ears."
He picked up Roland's gun belt and silently handed it over. The chunk of wood he had been working on lay nearby. He grabbed it and tucked it into the pocket in the back of Susanna's wheelchair as the gunslinger slowly buckled the wide leather belt around his waist and cinched the rawhide tie down.
"In shutdown phase, 1 subnuclear cell operating at 1% capacity.
These cells," Susanna followed Eddie, holding in her lap a carry-all bag she had sewn herself. As Eddie handed her the hide, she stuffed them into the bag. When all of them were stored away, Roland tapped Eddie on the arm and handed him a shoulder pack. What it contained, mostly, was deer meat, heavily salted from a natural lick Roland had found about 3 miles up the little creek. The gunslinger had already donned a similar pack. His purse, restocked and once again bulging with all sorts of odds and ends, hung from his other shoulder. A strange homemade harness with a seat of stitched deerskin dangled from a nearby branch. Roland plucked it off, studied it for a moment, and then draped it over his back and knotted the straps below his chest. Susanna made a sour face at this, and Roland saw it. He did not try to speak. This close to the bear, he couldn't have made himself heard even by shouting at the top of his voice, but he shrugged sympathetically and spread his hands. "You know we'll need it." She shrugged back. "I know, but that doesn't mean I like it." The gunslinger pointed across the clearing. A pair of leaning, splintered spruce trees marked the place where Shardik, who had once been known as Mir in these parts, had entered the clearing. Eddie leaned toward Susanna, made a circle with his thumb and forefinger, then raised his eyebrows interrogatively. "Okay?" She nodded, then pressed the heels of her palms against her ears. "Okay, but let's get out of here before I go deaf."